Majors and Quinn presents
James Linfesti and Sue Smolin.
Thank you. The joys of poetry, thank you for coming out in the world. For the purposes of the podcast, I'm shocked that there are 10,000 of you here. I didn't expect that many. And it's a joy to have you here. This is the world of poetry, and we're thrilled to do it, to work backwards. So I'm James Linfesti, and I'm here with Sue Smolin. Sue is one of my great friends and a fabulous poet, and I've done readings with a variety of people. I want to do, always want to do it with Sue because her voice is so beautiful. So, of course, she has bronchitis tonight. So I don't know. It's still beautiful, but it may have a little gravel in it as opposed to the pure music of the pure honey of poetry songs. She's a wonderful poet and a great friend. Well, I tell you, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about this book, Working Backwards. Tomorrow is the opening of the Bee and Pollinator Research Lab at the University of Minnesota from 2 to 6 p.m. at the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota. I'll be there the whole time signing books, and they're going to have food trucks and tours. And this is a great, great hopeful event in the life of our pollinator friends and cousins because they're in deep trouble. The bees are in deep trouble. The butterflies are in deep trouble. At least 30% of the wild species of bees in Minnesota that we only because we can count those are already extinct. I mean, we're in a holocaust of our insect cousins, and now the honeybees, who have been reliable friends to humanity for 5,000 years at least, back to the pharaohs, and 2,500 years at least back to Sappho and her one of her fragments, which is the earliest recording fragment of poetry that we know about bees. So this book came about because of that. I'd followed the career of Dr. Marla Spivak, who is a MacArthur-winning entomologist at the University of Minnesota, for years. And I also had this idea, why don't we gather poems for bees, kind of like the way the bees go out and visit flowers and gather nectar. And so I did, with the help of many friends, almost a decade, and gathered all these poems. And the University of Minnesota agreed to do it, and bless them. And then they also said, geez, but we need an introduction. And I've gotten to know Bill McKibben, who's a founder of 350.org, and actually my wife knows him better, and she said, it should be McKibben. I went, what? So I emailed him thinking he'd never do it, and he said, if you can wait till October, which we did, and he did that. And of course, Marla, and then I said, well, Marla should do an afterword. And what I didn't expect about Marla and her afterword, here she is. She's saving the honeybee, and I mean that. I mean, it's in the hands of these people in the bee lab because it's not happening out there in the world. That life is really rough for honeybees right now and wild bees. And not only did Marla write the afterword, she actually read the poems, which I did not expect. And her afterword is really quite sweet, if I dare say so. So we're going to do so just this week on Right on Radio, it was the Halloween show, and I got this idea. Well, I had to do some scary bee poems. But the first poem I'll do it is, well, it's sort of sweet and scary at the same time. But that's the title poem. I'll do this. Always have to start with that because the title is from Emily Dickinson. She probably wrote more bee poems than anybody. I counted 26, and we have a nice little bouquet of them in this book. And Emily did, but this one is, one of the genius, she was an absolute genius, as you know, a woman who hardly left the house except to walk in the garden and observe, often with her dog, observe nature around her. And she was one of the great observers of nature. And she incorporated the bees acted almost like bee guides into her world in the forest and the garden around her. And so, and she had a, she had a technique that nobody else did before, or as far as I know since. The technique would be, she'd ask herself a question that nobody had ever asked before. For example, how do you make a prairie? So she answered it this way. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee, one clover and a bee, and reverie. Reverie alone will do if bees are few. And I thought, what a perfect title for this book. The last line has that terrible poignancy about where we're going if we don't right this entomological ship. And also, what is reverie? Reverie is the turf of poets. That's what we do. It's just the imagination. It's the dreamlike state in which you are able to access your inner landscape to comment on the outer landscape. And so that's the title of this book, and we're thrilled to have that there. But so now, we're going to go back and forth. My job, do scary bee poems. Sue, with her formerly sweet voice, is to do sweet bee poems. So she's going to start with a particular one.
This is William Shakespeare, Ariel Song. Where the bee sucks, there suck I. In a cowslip's bell I lie. There I couch when owls do cry. On the bat's back I do fly after summer merrily. Merrily, merrily shall I live now under the blossom that hangs on the bough.
That's from the
Tempest.
Final act of The Tempest, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, in gathering these poems, I put out the word to poets around the country and around the world. And one of my most joyful responses was this from Carol Ann Duffy, who's the current Poet Laureate of England, and in fact, the first ever female Poet Laureate of England, who not only agreed to give us permission for her poems, but of course, like all the poets here, forwent, what's the term, any royalties so that all the money could go to the Bee Lab. But this is Ariel. Where the bee sucks, neonicotinoid insecticides in a cowslip's bell lie. In fields purple with lavender, yellow with rape, by which she means rapeseed, but also maybe it has that other meaning, yellow with rape, and on the sunflower's upturned face. On land monotonous with cereals and grain, merrily, merrily, sour in the soil, sheathing the seeds, systemic in the plant and crops, the million acres to be plowed, seething in the orchards now, under the blossom that hangs on the bough. The neonicotinoids are, as you know, are a form of insecticide that have many virtues, but one of the vices might well be that they're part of the complex of problems that the honeybee has, and it's a long complex. Yeah, and she cited that. They're systemic in the plant, and go ahead.
Here's another Emily Dickinson with flowers. South winds jostle them, bumblebees come, hover, hesitate, drink, and are gone. Butterflies pause on their passage cashmere. I, softly plucking, present them here.
Alas. Again, serendipity rules. You know, when you're a bee and you're looking for bee poems out in the world, you send out, you go flying out, and the little dance of your friends. And I had my wonderful friend Jim Heinen was at the Anderson Center, which, if you don't know about that, is this glorious art center and residential art center in Red Wing. And Jim, who was helpful to me gathering poems, said, sent me an email one day. Jim, there's a woman here at the having a resident with me named Aliki Barnstone, and she has this amazing poem called Alas, and she's become my friend because of this poem. She's the head of the creative writing program at the University of Missouri. Alas. All the days since the autumn equinox, I've been unable to get the word alas out of my mind. Alas, swirled on maple leaves burnished by rain. Alas, too pretty to be sad, though it signifies sadly. Alas, the birds alight too briefly before their southern leave. Alas, the lawn, monochrome emblem of the love of money, a single comforting species, its rank blades held aloft, poison-tipped, lethal, alas, to all insects except the few pests targeted. Lethal to little helpers and food progenitors, alas, too many mistakes for weeds, too many mistake for weeds and eradicate our wild violets and clover. I like the violets, heart-shaped leaves in my salad, shining with beads of oil. I like to think the soil likes the clover to fix its nitrogen, and the clover likes to be in the grass. Walt Whitman loves, inviting us to loaf and hum among wildflowers whose names recall daughters, home and harvest, pincushion, bachelor's button, and Queen Anne's lace, goldenrod, cosmos, and prairie aster, sweet alyssum, yarrow, and autumn joy, where bees intoxicated by nectar, not toxins, live to be our promiscuous pollinators. Isn't that wonderful? Yes. So you can see I had to have that one.
This is my friend Tom Hennin's outside work. On these autumn days when even the sunshine is cold, I feel happily lonesome as the wild bee that comes looking for one last flower before the snow. I move drowsily through the warm spots in the day. My muscles, too, are stiff if I drift into the shadows. The sudden chill makes me shudder. I move through the floating spider webs and reach a clearing in the sunlight where the earth itself is about to fall asleep in its own daydream. In the dream, the bee and I are both children in the same family. We have never left home. Everything tastes like honey.
Now another scary one. This is by the great Louise Clifton, this great mountain of an African-American woman who passed away a few years ago. I think, was she poet laureate once? I think so. She should have been. This is from her. She always wrote these very slight, simple things. You'll hear how unslight it is. Earth. Here is where it was dry when it rained, and also here, under the same what was called tree, it bore varicolored leaves, children, bees. All this used to be a place once. All this was a nice place once.
Mary Oliver, Honey at the Table. It fills you with the soft essence of vanished flowers. It becomes a trickle sharp as a hair that you follow from the honey pot over the table and out the door and over the ground, and all the while it thickens, grows deeper and wilder, edged with pine boughs and wet boulders, paw print of bobcat and bear, until deep in the forest you shuffle up some tree, you rip the bark you float into and swallow the dripping cones, bits of the tree, crushed bees, a taste composed of everything lost, in which everything lost is found.
That reminds me, what do you do when you're a bee foraging? You don't give up, do you? Foraging for the sweet nectar of poems. I put on Mary Oliver here, but she had moved from Provincetown to Florida. Her assistant had changed his email and all the contact information. Of course, the press gives you nothing. And I still don't remember how I did it, but I stuck with it and I tracked her down. And she picked up the phone in Florida and I said, Mary, I have to get the rights to these two poems. And you have to donate them. That wasn't the problem. But she said, I'll get you through the publisher and I'll take care of it. And then she hung up and that was it. And I thought, did she do it? Well, she did. And you can hear one. I mean, she's just a marvel. So now we have this. I have one really good British poet friend, and she led me like this again, like other blossoms in the field. She led me to a whole bunch of others in England. So there's quite a few poets from England in here, and some from Ireland, whom I met from some Irish poets here who got me into Ireland. A woman named Jo Chapcott, whom I don't know personally, wish I did. She was called The Sting. She has several of her poems are in here. Actually, no, I'll do the scariest one, the CCD. You know what that stands for? Colony Collapse Disorder. My body broke when the bees left, became a thing of bones and spaces and stretched skin. I'd barely noticed the time of wing twitch and pheromone mismatch and brood sealed in with wax. The honeycomb they left behind dissolved into blood and water. Now I smell of sweat and breath, and I think my body's cells may have turned hexagonal, though the bees are long gone.
I love that, the cells turning hexagonal.
Yeah, I know. She's so good.
This is Jane Hirschfield, Bees. In every instant, two gates. One opens to fragrant paradise, one to hell. Mostly, we go through neither. Mostly, we nod to our neighbor, lean down to pick up the paper, go back into the house. But the faint cries, ecstasy, horror, or did you think it the sound of distant bees making only the thick honey of this good life? That was a little bit scary.
Not so bad. Jane lives in paradise in Marin County, so she can't give you too dark a picture. Another Jo Chapcott from England, The Sting. When the wild queen leads the swarm into the room, don't shut the door on them. Don't leave them crawling the walls, furniture and books, a decor of moving fuzz. Don't go off to the city alone to work, to travel underground. The sting is no more Apis mellifera. That's the genus species name of the honeybee. There are lots of honeybees. The Italian honeybee is the honeybee that's our domestic honeybee, and they're the ones we want. The Africanized bees that you've heard about produce more honey, but they got a nasty temper. These Italian European honeybees are very gentle. I kept bees once. You can put your hand in the hive. I mean, it's the most amazing thing, isn't it? When they're ready for you. And I'll read you later, when they're not ready for you, it's trouble. So I'm going to start over. The sting, when the wild queen leads the swarm into the room, don't shut the door on them. Don't leave them crawling the walls, furniture and books, at the core of moving fuzz. Don't go off to the city alone to work, to travel underground. The sting is no more Apis mellifera. It's a life without honeybees, without an earful of buzz, an eyeful of yellow. The sting is no twin waving antennae breaking through the cap of a hatching bee's cell. The sting is no more feral hive humming in the stone wall of the house. No smell of honey as you brush by. No bees will follow, not one, and there lies the sting. The sting is no sting. Whoa. Mm. Fantastic.
Rumi, when grapes turn to wine. When grapes turn to wine, they long for our ability to change. When stars wheel around the North Pole, they are longing for our growing consciousness. Wine got drunk with us, not the other way. The body developed out of us, not we from it. We are bees, and our body is a honeycomb. We made the body, cell by cell we made it.
That's from the 14th century, and you can feel awfully good about that. I'll give you actually a happy bumblebee poem. I'm done with the dark poems. I'm sort of done with them. But this may sound like it isn't, but it is. Thomas R. Smith is a wonderful poet who lives in River Falls, Wisconsin, and really a former student of mine, and he knows much more about poetry than I will ever know. He's a beloved teacher at The Loft, has many books out. And there are several of his in here. This one happens to be right next to one by Sue Smolin. Now, this is called The Queen in Winter, and the epigraph is from an ecological calendar. Unlike honeybees, which survive by huddling together in the winter, bumblebees only live from spring to fall, leaving only the queen to live through the winter. She nods in her empty banquet hall, crown heavy on her sleep-heavy head. They are all gone, the soldiers and midwives, the blonde-bearded boys and fleet golden girls, floating tapers that animated summer, snuffed not by darkness, but by cold. The flowers are sweet, but only a little less lasting than the burly pollen wranglers that hummed and sailed the hot breezes. Now earth hardens, streams flow to a standstill, without and within, the castle door stiffens against the white winds that bend the stems low. In her brain, the year dwindles to a dim star or the ghost of the last dandelion. Alone in the vast warmth of her sleep, she preserves in silence a royal word that will restart the world's stopped pulse and call back that court the wind has blown away. The queen in winter, the bumblebee queen in winter.
This is from Jeannie Tomasco, called Sweetness. God gave the honeybee 6 weeks, and so she flies 500 miles in short refrains of alleluias to windy white clover fields, to pink and proper rose gardens, gathering nectar in that careful needle, taking no time for self-pity, though her life's work, together with that of 11 sisters, was the teaspoon of honey I just stirred into my tea. Sometimes she stops to walk on my sunflowers. Her sturdy legs grow heavy as she fills her pollen baskets with food for the bees back home. But I like to think her stroll on those upturned yellow faces is more for the joy of making me wonder what I know of happiness.
Who was that? I've forgotten.
Jeannie Tomasco.
Oh, Jeannie Tomasco. She's local, and I'll do another local, Morgan Grace Willow. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you get stung. This is called One Clover and a Bee to Emily Dickinson. I'd like to get my confidence back. That sense of play while digging in the dirt, the easy brushing away without fear of those bothersome things, bees in flight or creeping worms, death near at hand yet having no sting. No more. Not since that sting one July afternoon laid me out flat on my back, brought me face to face with the old worm, death, its patient presence in the dirt. The sudden discovery of an allergy to bees opens gateway to unknown fears. Yeah. I used to flaunt other people's fear, insist that bees never sting if you just stay still. Simply let them be. Now I take it all back. Before, I loved the garden's dirt. Now, the black tunnel worms. Now the black tunnel worms its way into everything. Even earthworms, welcome soil builders, bring a tinge of fear as I long to get my hands in dirt. Gardening's become a song of death, sting, and loss. No more bee balm planted out back, tempting wasps, yellow jackets, even honeybees. My favorite poem refers to a bee. I wear it on the back of my shirt. Bees worm their way through many poems, a paying back of dues, perhaps, not to be read with fear in these lines. Yet now, even that stings a bit. Even words now treacherous as dirt. It's hard to remove, persistent as dirt under fingernails, the threat inside each bee. I can't convince myself it won't sting, that it's as necessary to the garden as worms. Stored among rakes and hoes now is fear, which time won't reverse or take back. Dirt to dust, ashes to ashes, the worm, the bee, the newness of fear, the sting. I want my equilibrium back. There's another poem here about getting stung big time. But I'll tell you, the little Bee Lab advertisement here. One of the things they have is a program that any of us who live in the region can avail yourself of, which is to, they will come and manage your hive for you. And I've been a beekeeper, and they do require attention. Well, not come as a shock to those of you who know me that I was a fairly inattentive beekeeper, and my bees swarmed. Now, a swarm is the most astonishing thing that nature, I've maybe ever seen in nature in real time. I'll even tell you about it, because have you ever seen these? I mean, so if you don't, the boxes that you use, you start with one big box, and then you put what are called supers on the top, and these have more of the racks in them upon which they build their comb. And you have to keep an eye on it, because if it gets too full, what happens is the bees do what they do, of course, in nature, which is that they notice homes too full, getting full, so they produce another queen. When they produce another queen, then the queen, they all say, okay, time to start a new hive, to divide, basically to divide this hive. It's just magic. It's astounding. And so the queen then flies and has a nuptial flight with one lucky drone, and then they're done for. And she comes back, and half the hive follows her. And they end up, as they did outside my window in Deerfield, Massachusetts. I looked out the window from my hive, and I suddenly saw, what's that hanging on this tree near the hive? And it's this pendulous golden ball. And I went, oh, darn. I haven't been paying attention. So I madly got my Bee Guide for Idiots book, which is what we had back in the early 70s. We did not have the support of the Bee Lab and the kind of education they give. And I madly looked through and said, what do you do when they swarm? And I said, get another hive, put it down on the ground, cut down the branch that they're on, and shake it before the new box. I said, I said what you said. Yeah, right. I mean, really, that's a joke, right? I mean, but I went out, got a ladder, threw a rope over the higher branch, then got a saw, cut down the branch, which these 20,000 bees are hanging on in this ball. They're all around the queen, and they've sent out scouts to find a new place. See, that's their deal. And they're hanging out till boom, and then they get the, okay, we're going here. So I lowered the branch down. Here's the hive. They're by the way, very mellow. They're mellow because when they go, this is all miraculous, but when they know they're going to go on a trip, what do? They take out a lot of honey. Honey's food for them, of course. They take out a lot of honey, and when they have a lot of honey, like you and me, their bellies are full and they're mellow. Which is why, by the way, when you smoke them, it's the same thing. So what a strange thing to shoot smoke into a hive, which makes them, then you work the hive. But what it is, I'm sure that's like a forest fire signal to them. Okay, forest fire's coming. Take on honey. We got to go to move to a new place. So they do that. Anyway, I'm standing there. I take this branch. One shake, the bees fell off. And before my eyes, or I wouldn't have believed that they all immediately ran into the other hive. Walked, I should say, just like this, into the hive. I, for 30 years, didn't understand that until I asked Marla about it. And she said, well, was it already a used hive? I said, yes, they smelled it. And of course, they smell the other bee, the other propolis, the right in. It was the most astounding thing I've ever seen in nature. I mean, and literally to me, until I saw it, and almost still didn't believe my eyes. But that's what a bad beekeeper does. Read a happy poem for us. Or read a poem for us.
I thought this would be a good one to follow Morgan's.
Oh, good.
Nick Flynn, Blind Huber.
Yeah.
Sometimes bees, the glittering curtain they form, cling to my face. And the moment before knowing, I can imagine them a leaf, able to be brushed away. But they hold on. Their tongues seek each pore. As if my cheek offered nectar, they move delicately, caress and shade, as if not threatening to flood my eyes.
So I didn't tell you about the sting. That's what bees can do. And you've seen the pictures, I hope, and you know, beekeepers covered in bees, and it's they read your, you know your bees, they know you. I was gonna have a hive in my backyard, up on my back porch. And I and what you have to do if you want that, which I recommend, it's about the most expensive honey you'll ever have, but it's worth it to create and put the proper flowering landscape around. But what you're required by law to do is have everybody around you sign a release. And I went around to all my neighbors, and they were all happy to do so. And then my new neighbors across the street, he's Pakistani, she's Russian, they got three fabulous little kids. And they said, oh, yeah, I'll sign them. He said, oh, I do carry an EpiPen. He said that. And I went, ooh. You know, an EpiPen is, you know, and that's, he said, you know, and that means that's what this woman didn't have. And when you have an allergy to bee stings, it's a serious thing. You could die. Oh, you have them too. You have the same thing. You carry them too. Fantastic. And so that's, you know, the story. And then he said, but oh, that's okay. I'll do it. And then I asked his wife, and she said, no, I'd be happy to sign it. They're wonderful people. She said, I've only been stung once. I was in a refugee camp. Anyway, she was coming from Russia. She was in Austria or something. She said, I blew up like a balloon. I looked at her three kids. I said, I don't want to think about what a sting might do to them. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get the hive. But if any of you, and you probably don't want a hive, not when they're carrying an empty, no, because it's a serious, and it's sad, but it's a real deal and a real worry. So you don't want that to happen if you are if you have an allergy, which Morgan does too. So now the bees look different to you too a little bit. Well, I think we could end now. I don't know. You have a good one to end on? I haven't even thought about ending. Oh, I have one that's a crazy one to end on. But okay. you do one more right now.
Well, this is a little short one.
It's very good.
It's very sweet. John Barr, First Light. Spiders in the cold. Bees in inarticulate bunches hang from a day's work. Waiting for light, they wait to see what they will be. A tree lets down green undersides and is maple. A window glints, a thing of saffron kindles with singlehood. In the broad yard, each thing dandles its blue, its name, its consequence.
Well, thank you for coming. I think we can end with the first poem, which is a combination of an ecstatic poem and a bummer. So we get them both, because it's worth knowing both sides of this. One of the great writers walking the earth today is a Native American guy named Sherman Alexie, if you don't know him. If you haven't read all his books, just grab them. They just rip. And I've read them all. I put him on as a poet, which is rare. He doesn't do many poetry readings, but he's killer good. And of course, he writes short stories and novels. I bet you have a brace of Sherman Alexie in this place. Seek him out if you haven't. And I know all his books. I can tell you about him. But so I read this book in his last book of poems. Is called Face, and this one's in there. And I got permission from Sherman to do this. And it's in two parts. So let me you read the first part, and I'll read the second.
All right.
Because he's very smart and clever guy. Mm-hmm. And
it has an epigraph. If the bees die, man dies within 4 years. Attributed to Albert Einstein but likely stated by an anonymous source for political reasons.
And give the title too.
In the matter of human versus bee.
Legal proceedings. For the prosecution.
For the prosecution. The bees are gone. Who gives a shit? Other insects and animals can pollinate all the flora. We will survive because humans are adaptable. The bees are gone. It's a problem, but one will solve with good science and ambition. Certain bees have disappeared, but the other, more solitary breeds of bee are still alive and pollinating like porno stars. Who needs the bees that are too weak? Perhaps Darwin should be quoted to prove our point. The bees are gone, but won't stronger pollinators grow in number and amorous intensity? If you believe in a good God, as anyone should, then you must know that God will create more bees or replace them with something else equally good, because God is infallible.
For the defense, the bees are gone. No one knows why, not even God. Some blame cell phones. Some blame disease. A few blame God. The bees are gone. No one knows why. If they stay gone, all flora go without pollen, and they perish, starved and godless, within 4 years. The animals will soon follow flora to dust, and then we die. Nothing can stay, because the bees are little gods who give us grace bloom by bloom. The bees are gone. I sing this song to bring them back. Oh, say goodbye. Or I sing this song to bring them back, or say goodbye, or to worship the empty sky. And together, let's do this together.
All right.
For the beekeepers.
The bees are gone. We need new ones.
Or we are fucked. Well, bless you for being here. Pass the word about the pollinator lab. Come on over tomorrow and come. And
what are the times again?
From 2 to 6. Mm-hmm. It's going to be fun. It's going to be food trucks and tours. And you'll get a sense of what's going on over there and how important it is. And this is a dream of the bees for a long, long time. There's never been such a thing on planet Earth before. There are other places to study bees, but nothing like this with this intensity and focus. We're fortunate, and the bees are fortunate, because as we started off saying, they're in deep, deep, deep trouble with a lot of insults that they're dealing with. And we still have plenty of honey right now, but I can even tell you why that is, because the bees don't last. They used to, the common thing was the bees lived, you would hive them over the winter, and then you'd start over in the spring. They don't last the winter anymore. You need a whole new graft. I mean, commonly, almost all beekeepers now start over with fresh bees every year. That's one of the, I mean, it's just an indicator of what's going on. Well, Sue, whose voice is magical. I didn't notice the bronchitis affecting you at all. And I don't know if you want to do any questions. I don't know that we need to in this group, but yes, go ahead. Well, thank you.
So to repeat the question,
okay,
right? Did this help Jim write his own bee poems?
Well, there's two bee poems in here by me, and there's two by my son, actually. And I'd written actually more bee poems, but this was not, it was the other way around. I'd already written those poems. When I gathered them, the ones by my son, who has a gift, astounding gift, and he, of course, does nothing with it except these poems would appear. I'm the only one who's ever saved his poems, so I found these two that are quite good in here. But the answer is the other way around, that I had these poems, that I wish I knew. I was thinking of just this one that I wrote years ago that I didn't put in here because it starts with Marla Spivak is the goddess of bees. And I thought, well, that's a little too much. Although, now that I think, I don't know why I didn't put it in, because it's true. And I actually ran down all the great bee people. I mean, there's an amazing woman whose name I'm not going to think of. I mean, the great scholars of the great others, I'm forgetting the names of these people, but the woman I'm thinking of was a nuclear physicist who turned her entire career to bees. There are people like this, and I sort of name checked them all, right, almost like a list. And I did that. But so this has been on my mind a long time. The anthology came more out of following Dr. Spivak's career. And the anthology came out of one other experience, which I didn't mention, that I did a previous anthology and got the, I don't want to say I got the bug, bad pun, but in fact, I saw what you could do with an anthology. And so, I did the same way. I just put out the word to people, and we began to gather. And at some point, like when my friend sent me a Leaky Barnstone's poem, Alas, and I began to get some others, I said, okay, we have a hive here now. And then I really pressed it to get, and I got all those English poems and so many others, but I knew that I had enough poems. In fact, we had, frankly, far more, mm-hmm. and we ended up editing them back down. So,
would you say that the poems inspired your activism, or no, activism was there?
The way I see it, thank you. The way I see it is both of these things are part of my life and all of our lives. The way I've learned to think about literature in general, the arts, is the arts are a way to access the inner life. Mm-hmm. That's what they're about, and you go down in. And you tell the stories that are down in there. It's not about accessing the outer life is to get Bill McKibben and Marla Spivey. You know, you go march against Keystone XL pipeline, which I did. You know, you do this kind of thing. You march in the streets for activity. You do, needless to say, we all know you do politics night and day. And I do that. And also, I used to work for the Star Tribune and wrote editorials. One detail about that that's interesting. I'd come home from a day writing editorials for the Star Tribune and my head would be hot. I spend a day writing poetry and my hands are hot. My head's cool. It's nothing to do with the head. So there are different, the kind of activism you're talking about comes from a different part of you. This book is not, I don't think it doesn't have any, except for the introduction, which is frankly damn good. That's my editorial head putting that together. And I frankly wrote it myself, all by myself. And it's really good. And it lays out the story and what poetry can do and what it doesn't do. Mm-hmm. And what it doesn't do, we as citizens and we as scientists and to support scientists like Dr. Spivak. So that's the story. Thank you for the question. I kind of wound on. Yeah. Yes, and I'd recommend, you know, for everybody you know, because it tells a story. It tells two stories. You know, it's an unusual book because it tells the inner, you know, the poetry tells the inner story and the other, so it tells both those stories as you go out in the world.